This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. And just ahead on Africa News Tonight,
South Sudan's government says it wants to bring peace and stability in the country this year after 3 years of fighting. The government is putting its hopes on the recently launched national dialogue.
That's Mohamed Yusuf reporting. Details coming up. Also, militants detonated two vehicles packed with explosives in Somalia's capital Mogadishu, killing at least seven people. And the Islamic State group has claimed responsibility for the New Year's attack on a nightclub in Istanbul, Turkey, that killed nearly 40 people. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, at least seven people were killed today in Somalia's capital when militants detonated two vehicles packed with explosives. The explosions occurred near Mogadishu's international airport. A security source told VOA's Somali service that two civilians and one soldier were killed along with the two bombers. Al-Shabaab militants have claimed responsibility for the blasts. The first vehicle destroyed a Somali National Security Force checkpoint. The checkpoint is near UN officials and the Peace Hotel Mogadishu, where officials and foreigners often stay when in Somalia's capital. The second exploded about 200 meters from the gate of the AMISOM base. AMISOM is the African Union peacekeeping mission in Somalia. Mogadishu is the frequent target of Al-Shabaab bomb attacks. The Islamic State group has claimed responsibility for the New Year's attack on a nightclub in Istanbul, Turkey. Nearly 40 people were killed. Turkish media report today that 8 people have been detained over the assault, but the gunman is not among them. Authorities say the shooter blended in with people leaving the club and is still at large. In addition to those killed, about 70 people were injured. There were about 600 people at the club at the time. Meanwhile, in Iraq, officials say at least 30 people were killed and about 25 others injured today when a suicide bomber detonated an explosive-laden pickup truck in a busy market area in Baghdad. Islamic State has claimed responsibility. The bomber detonated the explosives at a fruit and vegetable market in Baghdad's eastern Sadr city district, a mostly Shiite neighborhood that has been the target of repeated attacks. The attack occurred as French President François Hollande visited Iraq to meet state officials and French troops who are based there. South Sudan's government says it wants to bring peace and stability in the country this year after 3 years of fighting. The government is putting its hopes on the recently launched national dialogue. For VOA, Mohamed Yusuf reports.
South Sudan ended 2016 with more clashes between government forces and opposition fighters allied to Riek Machar. As officials tried to put together a team to lead the national dialogue, tension remains high in the countryside, and clashes are a common occurrence. A senior member of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition, Peter Adwok Nyaba, says the country's future lies in implementing the peace agreement that President Salva Kiir and Machar signed in August 2015.
The peace agreement was an opportunity to return stability and sanity to the people of South Sudan. Unfortunately, it is Salva himself who abrogated this peace agreement by attacking and chasing the chairman of SPLM-SPLA-IO to all the way to Congo and started military operations against our people.
South Sudan descended into chaos in December 2013 after Kiir accused his former deputy Machar of planning to overthrow the government. Civil war broke out when soldiers from Kir's Dinka tribe and Mashar's Nuer tribe started targeting each other. The peace deal signed in Addis Ababa was an attempt to end the fighting. The two sides formed a transitional unity government and agreed to a ceasefire. But last July, new violence flared in Juba, killing hundreds of people. The clashes led to Mashar fleeing the country. The three-year war has now forced more than 2 million people from their homes and claimed the lives of tens of thousands of South Sudanese. Kir launched a national dialogue in mid-December, calling for his countrymen to participate in the talks. But opposition members have expressed fear the environment is not favourable for negotiations. Deputy Information Minister Akol Paul Kodet disagrees.
We as a government strongly believe the environment is conducive for dialogue, but should any other South Sudanese think that the environment is not conducive for dialogue, let him also or her come forward and tell us why does he think or she think that the environment is not conducive for dialogue, and what does she or he think should be done to make the environment conducive. So this is the essence of dialogue. We shall dialogue over every step, over every issue of concern in our country.
Researcher and policy analyst with Saad Institute, Hial Timamer, says there is no political will to end the crisis.
People in South Sudan actually want peace, but this peace is seen as not having that wide acceptance. And so that's why you see it is struggling. It's difficult to be implemented because of the fact that all the parties are not embracing it. And the society as a whole, they want peace, but not in the way this peace was designed.
Opposition leader Mashar is currently in South Africa, and there has been no indication when or if he may return. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Uganda's government plans to open up a new South Sudan refugee camp in the new year, given the surge in refugee numbers. Aid agencies, on the other hand, are devising new approaches to refugee assistance, while the refugees call for improved social conditions. Catherine Nambi has the details.
The situation of South Sudan refugees in Uganda remains unpredictable. Even when it was thought that the restive situation in Africa's youngest country would have returned to normalcy by the year 2017, South Sudan refugees continue trickling into Uganda in search of shelter and protection. Uganda's Office of the Prime Minister, OPM, that is charged with refugee affairs, indicates that most of the refugee settlements are currently full to capacity, yet new refugees are recorded daily. Fred Buzu, a community service officer in Uganda's OPM, says plans are underway to open up a new settlement camp come 2017.
At the moment, we have two settlements that are receiving refugees. That is Rhino Camp Refugee Settlement, receiving new arrivals. We have expanded our operations. BDBD is still receiving, and it has exceeded its capacity. So we are soon closing receiving refugees in the BDBD refugee settlement. At the moment, we have over 250,000 refugees in the BDBD refugee settlement. The initial planning was for 150 refugees, but now this has been exceeded. So we are planning to open another refugee settlement in Moyo district. So either this week or next week, we will start receiving refugees from the other side of Moyo.
To the refugee aid agencies, the overwhelming number of the South Sudan refugees has exerted pressure on the food aid, with some contemplating new approaches towards supporting the refugees. Simon Ogwang, a UNHCR protection officer, says they are waiting for Uganda government approval to roll out a program of converting refugee food assistance into cash to better refugees' livelihood.
It is still a matter under discussion, the issue of conversion of refugee food assistance into cash, because the government of Uganda is not satisfied, and it is still yet to be concluded. I hope this matter gets resolved before we undertake 2017.
But as the government of Uganda and refugee agencies plan for 2017, the refugees, on the other hand, are calling for improvement in the social amenities, especially the health facilities. Samuel Tolit, one of the refugees, narrated to me his ordeal with a sick child in the camps before calling for an immediate solution to health care in the camps come next year.
When I came here, I was fostered a child with the World Division, and the child is 6 years old. And when I was taken to the zone where we are supposed to be located, I found that things were worse with the girl. She falls sick. When she falls sick, I had to rush her all along from that far up to here walking, getting here almost midnight. And this is what I can see as if it is something that is very, very, you know, affecting the refugees here. If it is arranged in the sense that at least if there's a camp that people are taken in, then they take the medication and they take the issues, the serious kind of issues like the sickness things, I think it would be better.
The number of South Sudan refugees entering Uganda is expected to continue growing come next year as the situation in their country still remains tense. Currently, 25,000 new South Sudan refugees are recorded at different border points into Uganda, with little or no signs of the number reducing in the near future. Uganda is host to about 800,000 South Sudan refugees, many of whom have entered the country fleeing the recent violence that broke out between forces loyal to President Salva Kiir and his then Vice President, Riek Machar. For VOA, this is Catherine Nambi reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
About 1,000 sub-Saharan Africa migrants stormed the fences yesterday at the Spanish enclave of Ceuta. The 18 square kilometer enclave is located on the north coast of Africa on Morocco's western border. Reports say none of the migrants was able to break through a high double fence, but witnesses describe the assault as extremely violent and organized, as migrants used iron bars, wire cutters, and large stones. Several people were reported injured. There was a similar assault on Ceuta on December 9th, when about 400 migrants managed to break through the fence. The enclave is considered a gateway to enter Europe. Seventeen past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. A legal battle now follows Gambia's December 1st presidential election. In those polls, Yahya Jammeh lost to Adama Barrow, who led a coalition of 8 opposition parties. Jammeh's ruling APRC party soon filed a petition challenging the results in the Supreme Court, the highest court of the land. Media reports say Jammeh has accused ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, of declaring war on his government if he does not step down. ECOWAS has said it may deploy a standby force if Jammeh does not relinquish power on January 19th. From Banjul, reporter Lamine Jate tells us more about the legal challenge by the current ruling party.
In the petition filed on the 13th of December, the Alliance for Patriotic Reorientation and Construction, APRC, is praying that the court declares the election void and the results invalid. The party argues in the petition that the Electoral Commission did not conduct the election in good faith. The petition case was first heard on Wednesday at the Supreme Court in Banyun, where it could not continue as the court did not have enough judges to constitute a panel to hear the case. The Gambia's Nigerian Chief Justice, who serves as the head of the Supreme Court panel, was the only one available on Wednesday for the petition. After adjourning the case to 10 January, Chief Justice Emmanuel Fagbele said 5 more judges are hired from Nigeria and 1 from Sierra Leone. These judges are due in Banjun, early January, to be sworn in and start work in earnest. With the coming of these 6 judges, there will be enough justices to constitute the panel to hear the case. Sidin Jai is a nominated member of the House of Representatives, otherwise known as the National Assembly. As the key member of the ruling APRC party, Honorable Njai said,
"The filing of the petitions by the APRC is based on Section 49. I just want to read Section 49, and I quote, any registered political party which has participated in the presidential elections or an independent candidate who has participated in such an election may apply to the Supreme Court to determine the validity of the election of a president by filing a petition within 10 days of the declarations of the results of the elections.
However, even before his ruling party takes the matter to court, President Jammeh, in a dramatic U-turn, rejected the outcome of the elections in totality and called for fresh elections. He initially had described the elections as the most transparent and rig-proof in the whole world. Meanwhile, under the laws of the land, no candidate in an election has a singular power or whatsoever to declare the results null and void, as President Jammeh did. Mai Ahmad Fati, an executive member of the opposition coalition that won the election, said the petition is an attempt by the APRC to legitimize the illegal action of President Jammeh.
We therefore dismiss the attempt to legitimize the illegal actions of the outgoing president and even the idea that his actions are capable of being legitimized. Any petition or process filed in court will be a further demonstration that the outgoing president and his party have no respect or regard for the Gambian people, are bent on ignoring their aspirations and undermining the transition process. The Gambian people should know that there is no Supreme Court at this point in the Gambia, and that there has not been one for a whole year, for over a year. That is to say, the Supreme Court of the Gambia has not been constituted for over 1 year. We do not recognize that the outgoing president has the constitutional authority in the last days of his presidency to appoint any Supreme Court judge in the Gambia for the purpose of receiving his petition.
A private legal practitioner and a senior law lecturer at the University of the Gambia, Malik H.B. Jallo, said for President Jammeh to appoint judges to hear the petition is at variance with the fact that justice must not only be done, but must be seen to be done.
Even if the president goes ahead and appoints other judges to come and sit on the Supreme Court, this now raises another legitimate concern of bias. Because we all know that the only reason why those judges would be appointed is to come and hear this matter. And we know that the biggest stakeholder in this matter is President Jammeh. So it's been him all along, talking about the results not being free and fair, talking about the results manifesting irregularities. So he's the biggest stakeholder in all this. He's a party for all intents and purposes. So to allow him now to actually come back and appoint judges to come and preside over his own case, this is his case. Mm-hmm. I mean, that would be doing violence to the principles of natural justice. That would be doing violence to the principles of fairness. And that would be doing violence to the principle that justice must not only be done, but must be seen to be done.
The inauguration of President Elek Adama Barrow is expected to take place on the 19th of January. That is when the term of incumbent President Yahya Jammeh will officially come to an end. Lawyer Jallo explained that according to the law, when the election petition of Jammeh is not finally determined until on the 19th January, then the inauguration of Mr. Barrow would be done. For VOA, this is Lamin Jahate reporting from Banjul, The Gambia.
There were momentous gains for wildlife in 2016 on issues including performing animals, fur fashion, and international wildlife trafficking. This despite significant national and international challenges. The Wildlife Conservation Group has released a roundup of its top 10 successes for animals for the past year. Adam Roberts is the group's CEO. He spoke with reporter Kim Lewis about the victories to stop animal abuse and how the successes have inspired advocates to fight harder in 2017.
Well, I think some of the successes from 2016 could be categorized in three categories, really. So the first would be public education. Born Free, for example, has published two reports this year, one called Victims of Vanity, which was an undercover investigation into what happens in fur trapping in America, really showing the American public what's behind the cruel and brutal trapping of animals for their fur. And another was called Downloading Cruelty, where we explored the online trade in exotic exotic animals as pets. And then from that, you start to find a second category of success, which is community involvement, where people hear about the cruelty that's befallen animals in this country and try to do something to engage in the process of stopping it. One of the things that Born Free's done this year is have our third year of fur for the animals, where people can donate their used furs, and we repurpose them in an effort to give wildlife rescue facilities a way to take care of orphaned or injured animals who need warmth or comfort, and those furs provide that. So that's something where the public can actually become involved. And then the third category of success is actually in public policy, where, for example, this year, the United Nations Convention on International Trade and Endangered Species approved a suite of positive things for animals, listing all pangolin species on Appendix 1, which means no commercial trade in all 8 species of pangolins, preventing any trade in elephant ivory or rhino horn. So I think across the board, despite the challenges that we face, there have been some real successes in this past year.
The work that you all do is a global effort. So what is the international impact of the victories of 2016?
The work that we do is definitely international in scope. And, you know, these issues obviously affect animals everywhere. So you have people in Europe, for example, that also want to make changes with the fur industry. And while the most prominent impact of the fur industry in America relates to trapping of wild animals in the European Union, for example, you still have some countries that are keeping fur-bearing animals in these cruel fur farms. And so we've got a global fur-free retailer program trying to get retailers everywhere to stop carrying fur and to try and get designers to go fur-free. And of course, we've had recent successes in that regard with Hugo Boss and Giorgio Armani. So these really are globally impactful efforts that affect animals all across the planet.
These achievements, they were not easy achievements. So what were some of the biggest challenges that you all had to overcome?
I think when we look at the challenges that we have to overcome in order to get where we are with animals, the first thing we have to realize is how many challenges there are in the world. Obviously, you've got civil wars and refugee crises, economic problems. So there are all these different challenges, and we have to try and show both legislators, government officials, and members of the public that cruelty to animals should be considered as important as those other challenges. And then once you do that, the biggest challenge for us probably is having to fight the vested industries that are involved in these sorts of cruelties. So you have the fur and the trapping industry. You have the safari club and the hunters who want to keep lions in Africa under the gun, literally, while we're trying to save those species. You have ivory traders and whale, commercial whalers. So there is always a vested economic interest behind the efforts that cause the cruelty to animals. And that's probably the biggest challenge we face in trying to protect those animals from that cruelty.
And in looking ahead to 2017, what do you anticipate will be some of your biggest focuses?
Well, there's no question that the next year and possibly the next 2 to 4 years are going to be very difficult given what we've seen with the incoming administration, the fact that the president-elect's sons are both big game hunters. And, you know, I think we're going to have our work cut out for us. But many of these issues that we work on carry over year to year. So while we had great success in 2016, I think, in getting legislation introduced in Congress to, for example, stop the transport across state lines of primates if they're going to be kept as pets, the Captive Primate Safety Act, or 3 different trapping bills at the federal level to stop the trade in cruel, barbaric steel jaw leg hole traps, to stop their use on lands that are managed by the Department of Interior, Department of Agriculture, and to stop their use on national wildlife refuges. All of these bills that we got introduced in the past 2 years, we will now carry over and fight for passage and having them signed into law in the next 2.
Adam Roberts, the CEO of Born Free USA, he spoke with Kim Lewis from Washington. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. All other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports and tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Dan Crafton, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.